From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Divine, the male actor who became famous for his portrayals of women in John Waters movies. Divine plays both a man and a woman in Waters' new film, Hairspray. Also today, I speak with writer Gloria Naylor. Her new novel, Mama Day, is set on a Georgia sea island where the black community is cut off from the black culture of mainland America. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Doug Somm. Somm led the Sir Douglas Quintet, the only part of the British invasion to come from Texas. And book critic John Leonard reviews Season Ticket, the latest collection of Roger Angel's baseball essays from The New Yorker magazine. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Divine is frequently referred to as a 300-pound transvestite, but Divine thinks of himself as a character actor. Divine has starred in every one of John Waters' movies, usually in the role of a woman. Waters is the filmmaker who elevated bad taste into an art. It was Waters' movie Pink Flamingos that made Divine famous. If you've seen the film or the publicity stills, then you'll remember the image of Divine's huge frame covered in a skin-tight, low-cut gown. Divine played the woman who wins the title The Filthiest Person Alive, so filthy that at the end of the film, the character pops a fresh dog turd in her mouth. But neither Waters nor Divine is interested in that kind of shock value anymore. Divine is trying to broaden his image. He made a couple of movies independent of Waters. He played a male gangster in Trouble in Mind and played Tab Hunter's love interest in the Western spoof Lust in the Dust. Divine gets to play two roles, a man and a woman, in John Waters' new movie, Hairspray. It's a comedy set in 1962. Tracy Turnblad is a fat teenager who upstages the reigning teen queen on the local TV dance show. Divine plays Tracy's mom, Edna Turnblad. In this scene, Divine, as Edna, is taking her daughter to Mr. Pinky's hefty hideaway house of fashion for the ample woman to pick out some new clothes for the TV dance show.
Mr. Pinky, I'm Tracy's business manager, Edna Turnblad.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet the both of you. Here we cater to the big bone gals like yourself who are stylish and at the same time frustrated by the lack of sizes in the department stores today. I saw you on TV. I want you to be my model.
Would she be paid for this?
One free outfit a month. You start tomorrow. I hope there's no diets in the works because I want to design your Miss Otto Show coronation gown myself.
Could you throw in a pair of complimentary petty pants in the deal?
You drive a hard bargain, Miss Edna, and rightfully so. Petty pants, panty girdle. You just let Tracy take her pick.
It's a deal. Thank you, Mr. Pinky.
I'm going to make you a star.
Let me ask you to describe in your own words the two roles that you play in Hairspray.
Well, I think one is Edna Turnblad is a loving mother and adoring wife, and vice versa. And she has a child that wants to break into a dance program on television. At first, she's a bit leery, but then realizes that, in her words, she could be one of the Rockettes. So she thinks this is great and gets behind her 100% and becomes her agent and manager. Then I also play a part of an Arvin Hodgepile, who is a racist, sexist pig, and he owns a television studio. And he's just a hideous person. So it was great to play, because they're unlike any other characters I've ever done.
Are you glad that you played a dual role, that you played a female and a male role, so that you're seen as a character actor who's capable of performing in both roles?
Yeah, well, I've been screaming to everyone that I'm a character actor for the last 20 years. I finally, people are starting to listen, I think. Yeah, it was very important to me because in the last movie I did, I played a woman in, it was called Lust in the Dust, a Western that I did with Tab Hunter and Lenny Kazan. And the movie before that was a movie I did with Alan Rudolph where I played a gangster named Hilly Blue. So I thought it was time for me to do a movie where I played both together. And we approached John, my manager and agent, Di, about playing, when I read the script, the part of Arvin Hodgepile. And John said, well, sure, why not? He said, you'd be perfect for the role. He actually hadn't thought about me in the role, but then when it was suggested, he thought it would be good. And he actually sat down and wrote some extra dialogue and put some extra scenes in for me. So, like I said, it ended up to be a great dual role.
Do you think that audiences and directors as well have gotten the wrong idea of you over the years because you've played so many female roles?
Oh, definitely. I think it's the cliche Hollywood story of being typecast, and I'm definitely a victim of that. But I think I'm very lucky that I'm starting to come out of it. It's taken 20-some years. Like I said, I'm screaming at people, I'm not a transvestite, I'm not a drag queen, I'm a character actor. I never set out in the beginning of my career just to play female roles. But fortunately, or unfortunately for me, they were the only things that were offered to me. They were written for me, which is unbelievable to have that done. And they were the leads of the movies. So you don't go around turning down parts that are the leads or that are written for you if you're a young actor. I had no idea, though, that they would be such strong characters that people thought that was all I could do. But it just seemed that seems to be what happened. I mean, and also people thought I only worked with John Waters. It's taken a long time, but I have said enough on television and in interviews that I wanted to play more men's parts. So I think people finally started to listen. And they're fun. They're great. And they're what I would like to do a whole lot more of.
Let's talk about your roles in Hairspray. You really make a very sympathetic, beleaguered housewife. You know, really, you play the role with such empathy for the part. Did you know a lot of women like that? You know, women who were too busy to do anything because there was still ironing to do.
Oh, well, I didn't know them personally. My mother certainly wasn't like that. I mean, if there was a party, the ironing would have to wait. But not that she wasn't a good mother and a good wife, but she's a good time girl, too. But and there are women out there. I would see them, friends, mothers, and in different situations. So I'm sure they're out there, a lot of them.
A part of the movie is about hairdos, about the great teased bouffant hairdos of the early 60s. And I know John Waters is really enamored with those old hairdos. You used to be a hairdresser, didn't you?
Well, for a very short time. I'm glad I had that experience. It's come in very helpful now. Because when I'm on the road and things during my club act, there aren't always hairdressers available or things. So I end up having to do it myself. And I said, I'm glad I know how to tease because that's definitely the look they want. But I said to John, he doesn't have to go too far from his front door, actually, to still see women that look just like that. When I was doing the film, it was very funny because the first day on the set, I walked down the street. No one looked at me twice. I walked right through the camera crew, past John, and kept going. None of them looked at me. I came back and stood right in front of John. He looked at me, and he did a double take. It was very funny. He said, I can't believe that's perfect. So I looked just like one of the girls on the street.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, it was good. I mean, that was the best compliment. I mean, I did fit right in. I did look exactly the way I was supposed to. And because so often with my size and things, I'm so, what's the word? You know, not uptight, but about sticking out too much.
Self-conscious?
You know? Yeah, self-conscious. Yeah, about sticking out too much and being the largest person on the set. But then in a way, that's the best thing to do, I guess. You'd notice more.
Actor Divine is my guest, and he stars in John Waters' new movie, Hairspray. Let's talk about the male part that you played, and this is a kind of bad guy type part, a kind of villain part. He's the head of the TV studio who, you know, doesn't want to stand for integration. Now, John Waters told me you got fitted for new teeth for this role?
Yeah, well, they wanted me to look completely different, which is the great part of being a character actor, to look like the characters and to look different from yourself. That's why I said I never cared about looking always glamorous as a woman, which I always thought set me aside from being a drag queen or whatever, because I certainly looked anything but glamorous as Edna, with the long, stringy, oily hair. So in the same way, when they fitted me for teeth, big bucked teeth that had decay and things on them, then I had brown... because I have blue eyes. They poked me in the eye every morning for about 15 times trying to get these brown contacts in my eyes. And then I wore a toupee, which is the kind of hairstyle that men that are balding and they sweep it up from the bottom and over the top, mm-hmm. which really doesn't cover anything up, but they think it does in their own mind. And you can see the skin in between the hair, you know, a real dark brown because they usually dye their hair. So it was quite hideous, and with a little blue cord suit or whatever, and suspenders. And
it's great you had to put on as much makeup to do this male part as you did to do the female part.
It took longer. took longer. I used to pray to be Edna again. There were a couple of days when I had to be both, and I was running around with Edna's wig on and great big teeth sticking out of my mouth. I'd say, wait a minute, give us those teeth. Because you got, you know, after a while, you jump out of one into the other so fast, you forget to take half the costume off.
You know, it's funny, whenever you play the man, it seems to be the heavy that you're playing. Even in John Waters' film Female Trouble, in which you play a man and a woman, the man's, you know, a real kind of tough guy, bad guy type. In Trouble in Mind, you played a gangster.
Yeah, I think I'm stuck with playing just hideous people, you know, except for, like, Edna. She was like I said, sweet, kind.
Seeing Trouble in Mind was really a revelation for me. Before that, I'd only seen you playing female parts. And you played a gangster in the movie, and it showed such a different side of your acting. And it was a great performance.
Thank you.
How did you get that role?
Well, at the time, Alan Rudolph had a movie playing in New York called Choose Me. That was quite a big hit. And his office called my manager's office and said he wanted to have a meeting with me and with my manager. And was I available to do a film with him? He had written a new movie called Trouble in Mind, and he had written a part in it for me. So we said, well, sure, and we all got together, and he said, now here's the script, and if you want it, it's yours, and it's starring Chris Christopherson, Keith Carradine, Jean-Pierre Bugeaud, Laurie Singer, and you. And I thought, oh, yeah, sure, Chris Christopherson, I'm going to be in a movie with Chris Christopherson, I'm not Barbara Streisand. You know? So, sure enough, I would have done it for nothing, but my agent smacked me in the mouth and said, shut up, so you don't do anything for nothing. So we signed, and I went, and I still didn't believe it, actually. I thought they'd be Chris Christopherson look-alike, you know. But sure enough, there he was sitting on the set, and I thought, oh, my God, you know. And then I looked around, there was Jean-Pierre Bugeaud. So, I mean, they kept me busy and working, and it was great, because when I got killed in the movie, I got killed by the lead, who was Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Because I said to Alan, only Chris can kill me. So he said, no, exactly, exactly. And Keith Carradine, who's wonderful and really a nice guy, and which is what Chris told me the last day of shooting. He said, you know, you're all right, you're one of the guys, because when I heard you were coming on the set, I didn't know what to think, you know, because his daughter had told him, listen to me, I've got gender confusion too, told him all about me in the other films. He didn't know what to, he thought I was going to come in a spangled dress and a big sequin, you know, hat and wig, and so he didn't know what to think. But we all got along really well. I've been really lucky in all the films that I've done that the cast has gotten along really well. There have been no prima donnas or anything.
You know, you got started acting working with John Waters, and basically I think you were both still in school when you started. You were working with, what, Super 8 film?
Oh, yeah.
Shooting on the streets of Baltimore. It's not like you had come out of Yale School of Drama or something like that. You had this, theatrical background that you're going to draw on for your character roles. Did you ever decide, once you really got into acting, that you wanted to go to acting school? Did you ever feel like you needed that or that would help you in any way?
Well, sure, I thought about all of those things, but whenever I did talk to anyone about it, they said, "No, you have a natural talent. You have a natural ability to make people laugh. You have wonderful comic timing." And I sound like I'm sitting here blowing my own horn, but these are things that they told me. And I went to some very reputable acting coaches and people, and they didn't want to take me on. And they said, if something works, you know, don't fix it. Just go with it. And you just got to have the confidence and things to believe in yourself and to keep doing it, and you'll do it. So that's what I've done.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your acting career, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is actor Divine, who stars in both a male and female role in John Waters' new movie, Hairspray. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Divine is my guest. Did you love movies when you were growing up? What were some of your favorite films?
Oh, I've always had a very macho taste in movies. my favorites then when I was a kid were those Knights of the Round Table movies and war movies. And,
really?
Yeah. I still like a good war movie. I mean, Platoon and all those movies I loved. And I really do like Rambo movies and Sylvester Stallone. And Charles Bronson, I think, is probably my favorite.
So you probably really enjoy playing heavies when you get the chance to do that.
Yeah, I'd like to play in some of those movies, you know, where they kill 150 people in the first 2 minutes of film. It really does relieve, you know, any frustrations you might have, I think.
Well, you know, it's funny, in the movie where you do get killed in the Alan Rudolph movie, Trouble in Mind, you get killed in this house that is full of art objects. I think it was actually shot in a museum.
Yeah, it was shot in the Seattle Museum of Art.
Yeah, so not only do you get off, but all these, like, sculptures get get blown
up.
Oh,
yeah, they said, okay, knock that vase over. It was $500,000. No, it was about $50,000, this glass piece. I thought, oh, all right, so you just have to do it in one take. And I thought, well, this is fun, you know, going around breaking these $50,000 objects. But the artist had given them to him just to break. They were pieces that he thought were inferior.
That's great. So you liked really war movies and action films. Did you like glamour movies when you were growing up?
Well, anything that Elizabeth Taylor was in, I liked.
Did you like her better when she was thin or heavy?
It didn't matter to me.
Uh-huh.
Didn't matter. I thought it was just more of her to look at when she got heavy. But still very beautiful. And I finally did meet her one day, and I couldn't speak at all after years of planning what I was going to say to her. I was, blah, 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 blah. So I don't drink, but I went and had a double scotch and came back and had a little conversation with her.
Did she know you?
She knew of me. It was a party for her daughter, Maria, and her hairdresser and makeup man, a man, were people that I've used. And they had told her all about me, so she wanted to meet me at the party.
That's great that you'd use the same makeup man.
Yeah. We look a lot alike.
You know, John Waters has said that he really has always loved it when people who don't fit mainstream good looks take what they have and really turn it into style, turn it into, you know, an advantage. Did you feel like you were doing that when you were growing up? Because you were, I think you were always pretty heavy.
Yeah, well, no, actually not, because I was very much an introvert, and I never really went out of the house till I was about 16 years old. I was very uptight about my weight and about the way I looked, and always wanted to look like everyone else. And finally, my junior year, like when I was 16 and in high school, is when I really started hanging out with John and everyone else, that I got the confidence together to go out. And I was always in a coat. I always had a raincoat on or something. People probably thought I was a flasher, but I was just uptight about, you know, how fat I was. But at the same time, wouldn't do anything about it. Finally, I went on a diet, like I said, my junior year, and lost to 80 pounds and went down to 145 for my senior year. And then I was able to get dates and go to the prom and everything. But still, it was strange to me, because all of a sudden people talked to me. They wouldn't talk to me when I was fat. And I thought, well, what's this all about? You know, it was a rude awakening, actually, at a very young age.
So it must have been really liberating in a way when you started playing these extravagant roles where your weight was really a part of the role, and you were very theatrical about your size and theatrical about the way you dressed.
Oh, yeah, well, John did help me, I mean, to gain a lot of self-confidence and to be proud and not to fit the mold that I think they really do try to put you on, especially here in America, that you've got to be thin, you've got to be, you know, under 200 pounds. And I mean, you don't. I mean, there are a lot of big people out there that are still very beautiful people, you know. As long as you're clean and neat, this is fine, you know.
I think when you and Water started working together, you had a lot of exploits, both in the kinds of movies that you did and in the kind of parties that you gave, and shoplifting, from what I've read. But it seems to me like you were part of this, very kind of avant-garde theatrical type of into a theatrical kind of juvenile delinquency, as opposed to being like the real hoods.
Oh, yeah, we weren't really bad, you know. I think we were just bored, and we were young teenagers from your upper-middle-class families with nothing to do. I mean, I think the movies actually grew out of that situation also.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were making movies, we were locking each other in the trunks of our convertible cars and letting our friends out at the drive-in movies, and we'd drink a beer every now and then, which was, I guess, could be one of the worst things we ever did. We were never into any heavy drug scenes or into anything really, like I said, really bad that we would have to go to jail for, except a few bits of shoplifting. But I mean, all the kids did it, and so it was, I guess, a bit of peer pressure there about that, you know. But that was curbed too. I mean, it wasn't an everyday occurrence, and basically, we were good kids.
How did the tough guys in the school treat you, the people who really were the hoods?
Oh, well, I wasn't. They used to wait for me every day to beat me up after school. And to the point where I was quite black and blue and afraid to say anything because it had threatened my life. And it was very bad. And finally, one day, I had to go for a physical to the doctor. And when I disrobed, I mean, it was quite obvious that something terrible was happening to me. And finally, I broke down after a lot of questioning and told him what the problem was. And they called my parents, and when they saw what I looked like, they were quite hysterical. And we had the police at the school, and the kids were expelled. And it was quite an ugly situation, which made me even more unpopular with their friends and the other people, you know. But so I had to go through, like I said, the next 2 years of school with that stigma attached to me. But then I think finally, like I said, in my senior year, it was more or less all right. It wasn't so bad. But up until then, it was quite hideous, and I really hated school, and I hated the whole situation.
Have you ever gotten the chance to see any of those guys who beat you up since you've become a famous actor?
I have. I've seen them in theaters that I've played.
Have you really?
Yeah, and different situations, and I don't think they actually knew who I was.
Oh, that's too bad. You.
I knew that I had, in a way, had the last laugh. It did make me feel good, because I'm never the type of person to seek revenge and things, but like I said, they did really mess my mind up for a while, and my teenage years, you know, which were supposed to be the best years of your life.
You said that it was John Waters who gave, you know, who helped give you your image.
Right.
How did you decide on what that image was going to be when you first were getting
it together? Well, at the time, there were Andy Warhol, and a lot of people were making cult movies, and as they called them, underground films then, which were just the equivalent of your independently made movies today, low budget. And so the one name, like Viva, was very popular, so John gave me the name Divine. He just said he thought I was, and it was that I was funny and that I was divine, and it was a good name for me. And also because we had a very heavy Catholic upbringing, we had sort of religious names. So I don't know. Of course, the names became more popular again today with Madonna and Cher and Prince and Princess and all of these people. But did I go off the subject?
No. And then when you were getting like this... Well, excuse me?
I couldn't remember what the question was.
About forming the image when...
Yeah, so the thing was John wanted a very large woman because, as you had said before, he wanted the exact opposite of what normally would be beautiful. He wanted a 300-pound beauty as opposed to a 110-pound beauty. He wanted, as I've been called, inflated Jane Mansfield. that's what he got. And also, it's ironic that he would say the most beautiful woman in the world turns out to be a man. So everything there is backwards. So it's really a John Waters character. But then Van Smith, a very good friend of ours, who does all of John's movies, he does the makeup and costuming, and has done off, helped create the look for the character. And he's the one that said, go in the bathroom, shave your head halfway back, and pluck all your eyebrows out. So, I mean, you really got to trust people. I went in the bathroom and did this. Came out, I thought, what have I done now? But then he did my face almost like he always called a beauty gone berserk. And it was similar to kabuki-type makeup.
Oh, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the work that he does is quite beautiful. And also, we didn't want to look like a normal, everyday woman, because I'm not a woman. We wanted to look more like a cartoon character, you know, of a woman.
Had you dressed in drag before doing it for movies?
No, I think a couple times on Halloween or something. You know, I was Martha Washington once.
I'm just going to ask you one question about the famous Pink Flamingo scene in which the movie ends, and just one question about it, and then you have to eat a fresh dog turd, and you and John Waters have both said that you did it to kind of get attention, and the film really did. I mean, you were real upcoming people.
Well, John came to me and he said, well, you know, would you do this? And I said, oh, sure. I thought I was kidding. And a year later, he said, okay, now tomorrow you have to eat the dog turd. I thought, oh, this is great. He wasn't kidding, you know. And he said, well, listen, do you want to be famous or do you want to be completely forgotten about? He said, it's going to do either one or the other for you. It's going to make you or forget. You said, your name will go down in movie history forever anyway, no matter what you do. And I thought, well, what do I care? You know, I was very young, and you don't think about all these things. And I didn't really think about it until I had to follow that dog around for 3 hours. And finally it went, and it was quite a hideous experience, actually.
Well, here's my question. Did you rush off to an emergency room afterwards?
Well, no, I went home.
That's a silly question, but I'd be wondering about, you know, germs and things like
that. Well, I had mouthwash and things, and I brushed my teeth and goggled. Anyway, I went home, and I was sitting there. And the more I thought about it, then I started to worry. So I called the hospital, and I'll never forget this. And I didn't know what to tell them, you know, because I was a bit old running around eating dog feces. You know? So I called and I said, oh, hello, this is Mrs. Johnson, and my son just ate dog duty, and what should I do? And she said, well, how old is your son? And I said, well, he's, you know, 24 years old. And well, then the nurse got, she said, some maniac's on the phone here. Her son's 24 and he's eating dogs. So, I got back on the phone. She said, well, why? And I had to tell her, well, I said that he was retarded and that we had a dog and he was in the backyard playing with the dog. The dog had gone to the bathroom and he'd eaten the dog mess, you know. So she said, well, you just have to wash his mouth out and, you know, do all this. She said, but feel his stomach every day because he could get what was called the, you know, like a worm, a white worm. And every day I was feeling my stomach to see if it could. Finally, one day it got hard, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got it. But I had hysterical white worms as it was. I didn't have anything. So I was very lucky. But she suggested that I get rid of the dog.
Well, I know John Waters wants to do a sequel. You wouldn't go through that again for a sequel, would you?
No. I said, do I have to stand under an elephant the next time? Forget it. I said, I had to draw the line somewhere. So I said that was my last experience with animals, please.
Devine, you have a second career doing a club act and making records. This is in addition to the movie career that you have. Can you very briefly, because we're just about out of time, describe your club act?
Oh, well, I dress as a female character, who we've given the name Devine to, which is also my name. But she's very much like a lot of the characters that I've played on the screen. She's very on top of it, very bitchy, loud-mouth, vulgar. Talks, well, vulgar, which is what you would expect in a nightclub act, I think. And I sing all my songs that have been, I've had some very big hits in Europe, which have been platinum and gold, and I do those. I do two medleys, and it's been a show that I've done for about 5 years. I change it every now and then, put new material in, and as I do new records, I put them in. I have a new record right now that's 26 on the top 40 charts in London. So I've been very lucky that all my songs have charted, especially in England. And they're very popular, like I said, all over Europe and the rest of the world.
Now that you want to break into doing more male roles, do you want to give up doing the drag show?
No, I think as long as there's an audience for that, I'll always do it. I just, like I said, I'm a character actor, and they're just all different characters to add to my repertoire. So I would just, I'll keep doing them.
We can hear some of your new record in a second. Devine, I want to thank you very much for your time. Thanks.
Okay, well, that record will be available here in the States soon, so I want everybody to go out and buy it.
Well, my guest has been actor Devine, and his new film, Hairspray, opens this Friday. Devine's new record, Hey You, will be released in the United States in a few weeks. And Devine will also appear soon in the Fox Network's TV show, Married with Children. And you're going to play what? The brother of the husband?
Yeah.
Okay, looking forward to seeing that.
Me
Thanks
too.
A lot. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Edward James Olmos. He plays Lieutenant Castillo on Miami Vice, and he stars in the soon-to-be-released film Stand and Deliver. I hope you can join us. I want a sure shot. When I'm going tough, I want a sure shot. Who loves me when I'm rough, I want a sure shot. Firing through the night, I want a sure shot. Who always do it right, caress me. Fill me with desire. Do the kind of things to me that set my heart on fire. Arrest me.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Gloria Naylor. Her new novel, Mama Day, examines blacks from clashing cultures. It's an image Naylor can relate to, growing up in a Southern family in the middle of New York City. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the career of Doug Somm. He sang everything from blues to Tex-Mex before hitting it big as a member of the Sir Douglas Quintet, the British group that wasn't really from Britain. And book critic John Leonard reviews Roger Angel's latest collection of baseball essays, Season Ticket. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. House Democrats have agreed to a contra-aid package that will be voted on Thursday. NPR's Cokie Roberts has details.
When the House of Representatives defeated President Reagan's request for military and humanitarian aid for the Nicaraguan rebels earlier this month, the leaders promised nervous Democrats they would have another chance to vote on some sort of assistance for the Contras. It's taken negotiators for the various factions of the party weeks to come up with a package, but tonight they reached agreement on a $30 million plan. $16 million of that would be for purchase and delivery of food, clothing, and medicine for the Contras, the rest for children's survival assistance to be administered through private health agencies. The Contra aid would be delivered by the Defense Department with oversight by the Congressional Intelligence Committees and the General Accounting Office. Unless there's a ceasefire in place, then an international relief agency would deliver the assistance to the rebels. If negotiations for a ceasefire are underway before June 30th, then the assistance would continue for the rest of the calendar year. I'm Cokie Roberts in Washington.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has sent a letter to Cardinal Miguel Obando y Bravo urging him to restart ceasefire talks with the Contras without further delay. The cardinal, who is mediating the negotiations, broke off the last round of talks in Guatemala on Friday. David Golub has more on Ortega's letter.
President Ortega's letter expressed impatience with the performance of Cardinal Obando as mediator in the peace talks. Although his language was restrained, he made it clear that the government is angry over the cardinal's decision to suspend the last round of negotiations after only 5 hours of meetings. The talks were scheduled to last for 3 days, Ortega said. The cardinal's decision was abrupt and incomprehensible and was taken without consulting the government. Cardinal Obando said he called off the talks because the government did not immediately accept his formula for a ceasefire, and he complained that the government's negotiating team did not have enough power of decision. In response to this criticism, Ortega has raised the profile of the government's delegation, putting the Vice Minister of Defense in charge. Ortega said the delegation is ready to resume negotiations in Guatemala this coming Friday. Cardinal Obando has not officially responded, but a church spokesman described Ortega's criticism as improper and said he doubted the talks would resume this week. For National Public Radio, I'm David Golub in Managua.
Minnesota holds precinct caucuses tonight to choose delegates to the Republican and Democratic conventions. Vice President George Bush is not expected to do well. He has all but conceded defeat. Democrats Richard Gephardt and Michael Dukakis are in a tight race. The nation's second primary is underway today in South Dakota. Mike Merrick of South Dakota Public Radio has details.
Voter turnout across the state is being termed average for a presidential primary. The only election problems that have been reported are in the state's largest city, Sioux Falls, where television exit pollers were found closer than permitted by state law to the entrances to the polling places, at least in part for protection against chilly temperatures. Wind chill factors have been hovering in the 0 to 10 below range. South Dakota lies in two time zones. By state law, returns can't be released by county auditors until all the polls have closed in the state. That means precincts in the central time zone will have an hour to count ballots before the polls in the mountain time zone close and reporting begins. The two presidential primaries are the only races on the ballot today, so once reporting of returns begins, the results should be known fairly rapidly. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Merrick in Vermilion, South Dakota.
After dropping more than 15 points early in early afternoon trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down just over a point today at 2039.12. Advances edged declines in trading of 192 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 5 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of a musician who started out as a boy wonder of Tex-Mex music, Doug Somm. Somm performed solo and later as leader of the Sir Douglas Quintet.
There probably isn't another musician in the world of rock and roll as confusing as Doug Somm. From one minute to the next, he's a blues singer, a Mexican conjunto player, a rock and roller, or a country and western singer. The thing is, he's good at just about all of it. Doug Somm was born of Lebanese parents near San Antonio, Texas in 1941, and showed himself to be a very talented musician at an early age. His mother encouraged him, and soon little Doug was playing steel guitar in honky-tonks all over central Texas. He told me of a night late in 1952 when he was called to the stage at the Skyline Club in Austin and had to sit on Hank Williams' lap to play. It was Williams' last show, but all Doug remembers is how sharp his bony legs were. Doug finally rebelled against country music and began investigating the rhythm and blues scene in the largely Mexican west side of San Antonio. Soon, he was recording on local labels like Satin and Harlem. Some songs, like Crazy Daisy, were rock and roll.
You ought to see my crazy Daisy, but she's a-walking down the street. You ought to see my crazy Daisy, but she's a-walking down the street. She's the kind of a chick that every guy wants to meet.
But he also paid tribute to Sonny Ozuna and the Sunliners, a Chicano show band, with Just a Moment.
Just a moment of your time. Would you be
records were cut between 1958 and 1961, but they never got much beyond the San Antonio city limits. Doug had bigger ideas. The trouble was, Doug has always had a rather strong personality, and Sonny Ozuna's producer remembers getting besieged with phone calls from Somm begging to record for him. The producer was Huey P. Moe, who called himself the Crazy Cajun, and as the man who discovered not only Sonny, but also B.J. Thomas, he was mainly interested in singers. Doug's sandy rasp wasn't quite what he was looking for. But Huey Moe was dealt a losing hand by the Beatles. One day he was riding high on the charts with records he'd produced in his tiny Houston studio, and the next day he couldn't get arrested. So he took a stack of Beatles records into a motel with a jug of wine and spent an entire evening listening to them to see what their secret was. If only he could find somebody to cut some songs like that, he thought. And then he remembered Doug. All it took was one phone call, and Doug and his band were in the studio, making their first really big hit, She's About a Mover. Propelled by Augie Meyer's Vox organ and somebody shaking some maracas, it stormed up the charts. But Huey decided to pull a fast one on the public. Figuring nobody'd buy a bunch of boys from South Texas, he called the band the Sir Douglas Quintet, photographed them in silhouette only, and tried to pass them off as British. Well, as soon as they did their first radio interview, that ruse was over, but they still got a modest hit out of The Rains Came.
Rain, 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 rain.
just keep coming down. I haven't seen my baby left this town. Rain, 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 rain. My pillow's soaking wet. Broke my heart. Cause it's so much pain. Rain, 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 rain.
A dope bus stopped the quintet's career in the mid-60s, but they resurfaced at the end of the decade with Mendocino.
Sir Douglas Quintet is back. We'd like to thank all of our beautiful friends all over the country for all the beautiful vibrations. We love you.
Deedee Bopper, my teenage love.
After that, Doug and the quintet went their separate ways. He's still making records, touring mostly in Europe, and telling outrageous stories, most of which, considering what he's been through, are true.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Gloria Naylor. She won the 1983 American Book Award for First Fiction for her novel The Women of Brewster Place, the story of the black women who live on a rundown dead-end street. Her second book, Linden Hills, focused on life in a suburban, upwardly mobile black neighborhood. Her new novel, Mama Day, is set on a Georgia Sea island she calls Willow Springs. Like her previous works, it explores an isolated black community. Naylor says that the different settings of her novels allow her to look at broader issues faced by black Americans.
Willow Springs is not an actual place. It is based upon several of those islands that lie off the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. And that's very important symbolically to the work, because once you do cross that bridge from the mainland U.S. to Willow Springs, you've entered another reality. What intrigued me about that section of the United States and why I traveled down there to absorb the atmosphere was the fact that the blacks who lived in those islands were a people apart from even other southern blacks, because they had a separate history. And although that is changing now, I'd say within the last 20 years or so, but at one time they were terribly close-knit, and they kept several indigenous African traditions going, especially the tradition of using roots and herbs. And since that was central to the work, I just wanted to go and see these people and see this place.
Because place is so important in your fiction, I'm interested in the role of location in your life. Now, you're a native New Yorker, yeah. But your parents were from Mississippi.
That's right.
And I think they left Mississippi shortly before your birth.
I was conceived in Mississippi, as a matter of fact, and they got to New York a month before I was born. So I grew up in a very southern home within a very urban city, yeah.
Did they want you to know southern foods and southern customs, or did they want to leave that behind them when they came north?
No, it wasn't even an option. That's what we did in my home. My mom was 21 years old when she got married, so she cooked the way she cooked 3 months before she got married. They only knew one way of raising children and of expecting behavior and of shaping character the way they'd been taught. So, no, they didn't make a conscious effort, I guess, to throw off their southernness, anything of that nature. They were trying so very hard just to simply make a living, you know, because my parents weren't highly educated people, and they weren't from wealth. They weren't from any wealthy backgrounds. They were southern sharecroppers.
I think that some southerners who came north felt that the northerners treated them like hicks.
Like hicks?
Yeah.
No, my folks, no, did not have that problem. It was being black Americans. It was much more a problem of racism than regionalism for them. You know, and I think the greatest shock, what they will talk about, is that they had indeed expected that New York would offer more social mobility and wider opportunities. And once they came here, they found that indeed they could now vote. In Mississippi, they were not allowed to register and vote. And the first thing they did was to register and to start voting here. But they were still at the bottom of the totem pole when it came to getting jobs. You know, there were only a few places that they were allowed to live and that they could afford to live here in New York. And what they liked about the South was the fact that although the social restrictions were so terrible, the people were more honest. At least that was the case in the 50s, you know, and they didn't care for the duplicity that they found in the North, because it was just as racist. It was ultimately revealed to them, but it took a lot longer to find out what the outside world considered your place to be.
When did you start getting interested in reading and in writing?
I cannot give you a date, because all of my conscious life, I have been fascinated with words, you know. I learned to read before I was in kindergarten, because in the 50s women didn't work, not many women worked. And so my mother, to while away the time with us, she'd teach us to read, you know, and she'd take us to the library. And so when I hit kindergarten, I could read, and I was always fascinated somehow with the way books were put together. I remember opening them and smelling them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, certain library books really smelled a certain way.
They did in those days. I don't know if they still do.
I could never figure out whether it was the plastic cover in the library
books. Or
the glue on the spine.
I think it was the glue. I think it was the glue. We get high off the glue or something. But I've always read, always loved to write. When I was younger, I was very shy. And I didn't talk. And when I say didn't talk, I mean I say good morning and pass the butter, that kind of thing. But I wouldn't talk about the things that really mattered. And to this day, that holds true to some extent. But anyway, my mother noticed when I got about 12, 13, that I wasn't discussing things that she assumed girls would want to discuss with their parents. And so she gave me this little white plastic diary, and she told me that since I didn't want to talk to her and my dad, I should put my feelings down in that diary. And that was 12, 13 years old. And I can say perhaps from that point, I began to connect, trying to articulate what was inside of me with the written word. And I still sort of see what I do as a continuum from that plastic diary.
You've said that reading Toni Morrison changed your life.
It was discovering The Bluest Eye and discovering that black women wrote. Because I, like I said, I had been writing myself and reading voraciously from 12, 13 years old. And it kept going. Aborted. I don't know if you want to see aborted. I interrupted my formal education between high school and college. I took 7 years off, and I became a minister. But I was always writing, and somehow feeling illegitimate for doing that, a little freaky, for trying to write stories and trying to write poetry, because I didn't know any other black people who were doing that. And having gone through a basic high school curriculum in the mid-60s, you were not taught black writers. You were taught the English classics, and that's where I learned to love language. But I did not know about Gwendolyn Brooks, who ironically had gotten the Pulitzer Prize the year I was born, 1950. You know, I did not know about Zora Neale Hurston, Pauline Marshall, who was writing at that time. And in 77, I took a creative writing course, and we were exposed to black writers. And once I found out that indeed my story had been told by other people in various ways, it was sort of like a watershed moment in my life.
Until that point, did you feel that your own story would make for illegitimate fiction because you hadn't read other fiction like it?
No, I hadn't even conceptualized of my having a story. It wasn't even a matter of it being illegitimate fiction. It was a matter of my not thinking that there was a story to be told. You know, what I think now of benign neglect, if you will, on the part of academia at that time.
You mentioned that you became a minister for 7 years.
Sorry.
You were actually a minister in the Jehovah's Witnesses, right?
That's right. I traveled when I was a missionary for them.
How did you get involved with the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, it was the latter part of the 60s, and the world was going to hell. You know, I was looking at the United States Army invade Southeast Asia, United States Army come into Harlem and invade our streets, and I just thought that there was no hope for this world as long as men were ruling it, any type of men. And so that organization just hit a chord with me because they preached about a government, a theocracy, a government ruled by God. So men would have no say in it whatsoever, and that there would be this paradise here on earth. And so when you have a belief, you know, I was always taught that you put your money where your mouth is and you work for that belief.
Do you think in a way that being a Jehovah's Witness exposed you to interesting people and interesting places that ultimately helped you as a writer?
What it did, yeah. It taught me to care about people. And it also got me to open my mouth. I told you before I didn't talk.
Yeah.
Well, when I had a purpose, it helped to get over the shyness when I thought that indeed I was going to save some individual. I learned to open my mouth and to speak to them.
Do you think that the gap that was left in your life when you left the Jehovah's Witnesses has been filled by something else, a spiritual gap?
You know, that I don't know. I think that's yet to be determined, because maybe when I'm in my 40s or so, I can look back and see what all of this means and what it's given me. I do know this, that writing has always, before Jehovah's Witnesses, before junior high school, whatever, it's always somehow made me feel complete, and that is happening now. My life's become more complicated because my work is turned into a product. You know, and then people respond to a product, and they respond to you via the product. But as far as the process itself, that's doing for me what it did for me when I was 12, 13 years old.
Okay, Gloria Naylor, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Gloria Naylor's new novel, Mama Day, is published by Tigner and Fields. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, tonight we have a story on the Army deciding to burn aging nerve gas weapons on site at the 8 depots where these weapons have been stored. The question of what to do with these aging weapons has generated a lot of controversy. Those living around the sites were worried about having them destroyed there, around them, but no one wanted to be on the route that the nerve gas would travel if it were sent to more remote sites. Also, Caspar Weinberger was knighted today at Buckingham Palace. Being a non-Brit, you can't call him Sir Caspar. Three Guys in Dallas are planning to launch an airline just for smokers.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The crack of the bat hitting the baseball is the sweetest music for many sports fans. Spring training is in progress, but if you're wondering what to do with yourself till opening day, book critic John Leonard recommends the latest collection of baseball essays by Roger Angel called Season Ticket.
Of course, Roger Angel has a serious workaday job. He's an important editor at The New Yorker. But Angel engages the little boy in all of us at the deepest recesses of the imagination, when what he does instead of editing is go to a baseball game and tell us what he sees. Twice a year, these diamond dispatches appear in his magazine, as perfect in their way as a John Cheever short story or a Charles Adams cartoon. Twice a decade, Houghton Mifflin publishes them as a baseball companion, letting us look back over five seasons of spring trainings and World Series and to appreciate again that America has two hearts, the stock exchange ticker and the box score stats. Baseball has had its novelists, Philip Roth, Bernard Malamud, Robert Coover, and John Updike among them. But Angel is the poet of the game, somehow simultaneously a tour guide like Virgil and a pilgrim like Dante. He is also the fan's fan. He knows why we root. Belonging anywhere now is terribly difficult, he says, and the old childhood dream of really belonging will not go away. 1986, the last full baseball year covered in season ticket, was in many ways Angel's most difficult emotionally. He could talk, as he always does, to managers like Earl Weaver, pitchers like Dan Quisenberry, and owners like Roy Eisenhart. He could worry, while he'd rather not, about cocaine, Steinbrenner, free agency, inflated salaries, and inflated expectations. He could describe dozens of players as perfectly as he describes Wally Backman of the Mets, quote, his odd preliminary forward lean in the batter's box, with bat held upright as if to conk a burglar, the facial squinchings as he prepares for the pitch, the joyful little double jump and hand pop as he comes to a dusty stop beyond first with another base hit, and, contrary-wise, his disbelieving, Rumpelstiltskin stamp of rage when a pitcher has caught a corner against him for strike three. But in 1986, Roger Angel's two favorite teams finally met in the World Series, as mine did, and he had to choose between them, as I did, and he chose the Mets over the Red Sox, and so did I, and he feels awful about it, but there we are. I discovered, after 20 years of existential doubts, that where I really belong is New York. I don't know about Angel, except, of course, that he writes like one. All fans, he tells us, want good news forever, for everything to go perfectly for teams and players we care about. But if we always won, quote, we would have lost baseball, and then we would have to look around, without much hope, for something else to care about in such a particular and arduous fashion. Explaining why he talks about hitting so often to journeymen and so seldom to stars, he says, the best may be awesome to observe, but not especially rewarding as a subject for study. You can take apart a pocket watch, but not a sunset. Maybe, but this book, so full of colors and rhythms and planetary movements, looks to me a lot more like a sunset than a pocket watch.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Season Ticket by Roger Angel. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Robert Parker, one of the world's most influential wine critics, and we'll find out how he clears his palate while tasting about 200 wines a week. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review Lutosławski Conducts Lutosławski. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will continue his discussion of sexism in language. He says the obvious concerns, like whether to use mankind or humankind, only scratch the surface. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.